There are many hundreds of codices. 40 of the most important indigenous codices are found abroad, 15 in Paris, 4 in Madrid, 6 in the Bodleian Library of Oxford University, 4 in the Vatican Library, 2 in Florence, and the public libraries of Liverpool, Dresden, Bologna and New York, Berlin, New Orleans, and Basel. Some of these have at least one apiece. How did they get there? And what is the story behind the ancient codices of the Western Hemisphere? The vicissitudes of each codice or book could be woven into an interesting story. It would involve such things as an imprisoned scholar attacked by pirates or the victim of persecution, a picture in which Spanish missionaries and Indians all take part, along with pirates, scholars, astronomers, antiquarians, descendants of the last Aztec king, royal families of Spain, Portugal, Germany, and England, cardinals, children, and servants. All of these are involved in the story we're about to relate. Two personalities stand out, of course, Cortez and Charles V of Spain. One of them shipped strange manuscripts back to Spain without being aware of their value, and it is not certain if the other, King Charles V of Spain, ever laid his royal eyes on them. In the year 1840, a Mr. Joseph Marius Alexis Aubin, former professor of the Superior School or High School of Paris, was taking his final leave of Mexico. Fearing that custom officials in Veracruz would confiscate the ancient Mexican documents he carried, he tore out some of their pages, erased seals and dates, and produced such a state of chaos in the material he was never able to straighten it out. Due, however, to these precautions, he was able to smuggle from Mexico one of the most valuable treasures of Mexican culture and transport it to Paris, where it has remained ever since. Now, the painted books, which are often the name given to the pictorial works and commentaries in native tongue that were drawn by the Mayas, the Aztecs, the Mixtecs, and found likewise in the Olmec and other cultures of Mexico and North and South America, to a lesser extent also by the Tarascans and the Otomists, were on strips of scraped deerskin or on bark or on the ficus tree, the bark from the amaral tree. According to Aztec mythology, the god Quetzalcoatl invented writing, or at least brought it to them. According to Maya mythology, hieroglyphs were invented by the lord of the sun's eye, Kanichiwa. Those of you who have an ear for Japanese might want to explore the significance of Kanichiwa and the lord of the sun's eye between the Japanese and the Western Guatemalans. The ancient Mexicans manufactured their particular material for pictorial works not only from deerskins, but from the bark of the fig tree, of which there are 700 genera of the ficus, 50 which are found in Mexico alone. They also wrote on the maguey fiber. The analysis of the most ancient Maya codex, for example, the Dresden codex, proved it was made from the bark of the ficus cantifolia, which grows abundantly in Yucatan. The maguey plant has the honor of being the inexhaustible source of fiber as well as pulque. The reader may ask whether it was the Maya or the Aztec who first invented paper. There were predecessors, however, to both. And to these ancient predecessors in the Gulf of Mexico region, we might attribute the origins of paper. The painted books were undoubtedly of great value to the ancient inhabitants of this continent. Among the objects that Moctezuma offered Cortez, along with a golden wheel and necklace, were two books of the kind used by the Indians. As could be expected, these did not arouse the faintest interest of the conquerors. How could these people, who thirsted after gold like hungry swine, possibly be interested in some accordion-like painted books? The first one to be amazed by these two books that the Indian used was Pedro Martir de Anglerie, to such an extent that he soon made them known to the world. In his letter to Pope Adrian, he writes, "Wherever you open the book, it always shows two written sides, and in each fold are two pages, unless you spread it all out," he adds. "The pages of these books on which they write are made of the bark taken from trees, from the material that grows beneath the outer layer." It is clear that at least the codices constituted a kind of memorandum written by the priests and designed for meditation. Perhaps in some instances only the priests were able to interpret them. The Tarnalamatal or day paper was by no means a text designed for the instruction and enlightenment of broad sectors of the populace. It was not a book for everyone. It constituted a kind of manual for the exclusive use of the priest, whose duty was to instruct and direct in all decisive matters of life, religious matters, political and social ones, by interpreting what was written in the figurative symbols on the codices. Now, Bishop de Landa, who in 1562 publicly burned the Mayan manuscripts in the city of Manai, south of Merida, writes that the priests would take out the books, extend them on a cool foliage, and then search them out for the things that they needed to know. When the Spaniards arrived in 1519, writing in Mexico had reached a certain level, perhaps not exactly like the Egyptian or the Chinese, but the level of development was still such that the symbols, images, and hieroglyphs communicated all that was necessary for these people. Thus, death is represented by a mortuary bundle, conquest by a temple pierced with an arrow. A serpent hanging from the sky represents rain. Drought and famine are depicted by a red serpent pierced by an arrow, meaning that fertility is interrupted. Among the Maya, the tortoise was the symbol of the summer solstice, the snail of the winter solstice. The tortoise and the snail are animals that move slowly. The tortoise was also the glyph for the tempest among the Mayan. The eagle, the deer, the snake, and the butterfly were all symbols for the sun. The butterfly, in addition, represented flame and the soul of the dead, who, according to the ancient belief, accompanied the sun on its journey through the sky. The symbol of the moon was the rabbit. A broken tree represented Tamanakyan, the mythical paradise where the individuals had formerly lived. Four worlds had been destroyed before the present fifth one took shape, and in a future tape we will deal with the fifth world, doctrines and religious content recently recovered from ancient documents and other sources that deal with the thought of the ancient Mexicans, Central Americans. Four gods created the world. The universe extended in four directions. Four caves marked the entrance to the lower world, crossed by four paths, black, white, red, and green. Number seven was linked with the seven stars of the Big Dipper, and seven tribes of Atzilon departed from the seven caves for their journey to Anahuac. Nine is the number to denote everything occurring under the earth. 13 is for the heavens wherein dwell the gods. The Mexican century was composed of 52 years. 13 hours out of the ancient Mexican's day belonged to the world of light, and 9 to the world of darkness. 20 was man himself, because his toes and fingers totaled 20. The Mayan word yunal, 20, is derived from yunac, man. Now, although I rapidly went over some aspects of these, there are tapes, 107, 110, dealing with the geography of the universe in the books of Enoch, the astronomical aspects of some parts of the comments just made will be found in tape number 82 and 90. There's a great deal more when one goes into the depth and details of the symbols. For instance, the seven tribes who departed from the seven caves for their journey, one would want to check the Book of Mormon very carefully, and he'll start to see certain great parallels. The Nuwas, for example, had adequate ideograms for representing metaphysical concepts, such as God, symbolized by the sun, movement, life, etc. A star was represented by an eye, the spoken word by a volute emerging from the mouth of the person speaking. A row of footprints indicated a path. Color also had symbolic meaning. For example, black was for night and for death. This was obvious. Some of the gods portrayed in the codices, such as Tezcatlipoca, the smoking mirror, lord of the kingdom of the dead, as well as priests performing rites, were painted black. White was related to the concept of twilight or remote epoch. Red was blood and fire, the color of Tuanatua, god of the sun. It was also the color of the god of springtime and patron of jewelers, Chipitotec. Sometimes the god of death was painted red when the precious liquid blood that gave nourishment to the god of the sun spouted from his heart. A human figure in yellow most always portrayed the feminine sex, the color purple royalty. Color purple seems to have been universal for a designation of royalty. Well, the codices are historical and religious, Some deal exclusively with religion, others gods and astronomy, royal genealogy and customs relating to man's life cycle from birth to death. Matolina wrote that the native inhabitants had five books of figures and characters. The first dealt with years and times, the second with days and festivities celebrated throughout the year, the third with dreams, delusions, and vanities, and omens in which they believed. The fourth book was on baptism and names given to children, and the fifth on rites and ceremonies and omens related to marriage. These books, entitled Tuan Lamatl, had to be consulted before going on a journey. They were called the day books, or making any important decisions, such as beginning a war, contracting a marriage, baptizing a child. Only three Mayan codices, totaling a mere 250 pages, 13 Mixtec, 9 Aztec, and some of other origins have survived. None of the Mayan codices recount historical events. The only Aztec one to do so is the Boturini, which records the Aztec pilgrim from Atlan to the area of Tonokitlan, today the capital of Mexico. In contrast, the Mixtec codices relate events that occurred from the year 5 Pedernal, or about 692 AD, until the end of the 16th century. Most of the codices were burned by the Spanish missionaries. Juan de Zumárraga, appointed the first Archbishop of Mexico in 1547, he helped introduce the printing press and found the university, prided himself in a letter on the fact that his monks had up to the moment destroyed 500 temples and smashed to pieces 20,000 idols. It is easy to imagine how many inscribed surfaces and codices, which the archbishop did not consider even worthy of mention, were destroyed by him. The Mexican historian Claviero writes, "The first missionaries, assuming all of them to reflect superstitions, pursued them with fire and sword." In other words, the books were considered to be superstitious and satanic. They laid their hands on as many as they could, and where the main school of painting was located in Tetzuco, and erected an enormous heap to which they set fire in the marketplace. But it was not only the Spanish missionaries who burned the incalculably precious heritage of the indigenous people. The fourth Aztec king, Itzcoatl, 1428 to 1478 AD, decided to destroy part of the ancient codices in order to give his people a new version of Aztec history. The lord and the chieftains resolved and ordered that all should be burned, so that they would not fall into the hands of the common people and be held in contempt. Sahagún, who we'll hear about later, was able to reestablish some of that ancient material. But at any rate, the loss suffered by Mesoamerican cultures as a result of this vandalism by all parties involved, both indigenous cultures and the conquerors, is beyond reckoning. Some of the Spanish clergy, among them Fray Bernardino de Sahagún, whose great merit is that he endeavored to save the culture and inheritance of the conquered people, understood that the conversion of the Indians to Christianity could only be accomplished if the missionaries had precise knowledge of native thought and culture. Thanks to him, three of his indigenous pupils, one of which was each little Chochitl, at the end of the 16th century and beginning of the 17th, gathered together the traditions and customs of their families. A very famous document is the chronicles of each little Chochitl, who is the descendant of an Aztec king, a royal, noble individual. The parallels to Mormonism in this great account of Aztec history by each little Chochitl is paramount. It's been published elsewhere. We'll refer to it in future tapes. And then there's another document that came to light at the end of the 19th century. In fact, most of the codices first came to light at the end of the 19th century. This one was called Becker I, or the manuscript of the Cachiqui. A native whose name is unknown used it when defending his right to a piece of land. After winning the suit, his defender, Pascual Almazan, asked to be paid with the manuscript instead of money, a request which the peasant gladly complied with. Today, it bears the name of Becker instead of the individual who originally possessed it. And it was not until 1945 that another codex was found, this time in Spain. Its owner, Mr. Castro, sold it to the Museum of America after a long negotiation. The codices are of different size and have acquired their names by mere chance. For example, the Nuttall, which has 48 pages and measures more than 11 meters long, about 33 feet, bears the name of Zila Nuttall, who found and studied it. This is my copy of the Codex Nuttall. It's a very beautiful, well-done document in color. It's probably one of the most artistic of all the documents. She lived just right outside of Mexico City, just south of the city. Many professional people often visited her. The story of her acquisition of documents and her contribution is really an interesting one. We only have time to briefly comment upon it. Another document, the Vindobonensis, which is more than 40 feet long and has 52 pages, bears the name of the place where it was now to be found, in Vienna. And then the Codex Telleriano Rimensis was the property of the Bishop of Reims, Charles Maurice de Tellier. The Humboldt Codex is thus called as a tribute to the famous traveler and ethnographer who visited Mexico. The oldest medicinal codex is only 6 inches wide by 8 inches high. It's called by the name of Juan Badianus, who translated it into Latin. There are 184 illustrations in the Badianus Codex. These are the earliest illustrations of Aztec flora, and aside from medical science, it contained myths and beliefs of the natives dealing with the power of stones and animals. It was discovered in 1929 in the Vatican Library by Professor Charles Upton Clark. The chronicles speak of big deposits of books formed at the expense of the state, a kind of archive or library where documents of the nations were held in custody. The biggest library was located in Texcoco. In the book Burning Water, which we'll be referring to from time to time, Thought and Religion in Ancient Mexico, Loretta Sojourné, an archaeologist resident in Mexico today, refers constantly and many times to the libraries and to the documents, and she makes much use in eliciting from them the deep thought religion of ancient Mexico. Red, blue, purple, black, and gray are of special importance in the Mixtec colors in use in the codices, while in the Mayan codices, most of the drawings are painted in black. The Mexica Codex, called Borderini, does not have any color. Its very delicate drawings are reminiscent of Chinese designs. Even among the post-Hispanic Aztecs, Donald Robertson distinguished several schools where texts were prepared. One near Mexico City, one at Texcoco, and one at Tlatelolco. The codices are written in at least three different ways. One of these consists of pictographic writing that represents events by means of images. At Stanford University, Professor Fox may be on the verge of understanding a great deal more of the ways in which these documents have been written and their interpretation. The second way the ancient Mexican had of writing was by ideographic symbols. Chinese writing is the best example of the ideographic type. The idea of sorrow is represented by the Chinese as a woman standing beneath a door. She's painted twice. This kind of symbolism, of course, will require understanding on the part of anyone reading it to really be able to interpret it. Another class of writing used by the ancient Nahuas is phonetic. The Maya used ideographic writing and phonetic signs to a greater extent than the Nahuas. The Mixtecs and the Mexica, the latter erroneously sometimes called Aztecs, employed the three methods and arrived at principles of Sibyllic writing. In spite of the countless attempts to decipher Mayan writing, it continues to be shrouded in mystery. The hope that someday this riddle can be solved rests today on the Englishman J. Eric Thompson and the Center for Maya Studies of the National University of Mexico under Director Dr. Alberto Ruiz Lujillier. However, even though Dr. Thompson has now provided a huge three-volume set, of which here I have this large green book, The Mayan Hieroglyphic Writing, we're still far from understanding the documents. When Cortes arrived at Mexico, he interrupted the course of the development of writing, which was in the process of changing into a phonetic system. While the ancient Mexican writings constitute a riddle for us, missionaries of the 16th century asserted that to those who understood them, they were as clear as ours and as easy to read and understand. Just as the Japanese and the Chinese writing is quite understood by those trained in it from early days, likewise, the Central Americans and Mexicans were quite familiar at an early time in the nature and character of their documents. But tragic lives that involve exceptional, rebellious, and inquisitive spirits, lives that contain the contradictions of their times, investigators and captains hidden beneath the friars' habits, tireless travelers, ethnographers, and collectors. Such were the men who rescued, discovered, and recovered the painted books from oblivion and interpreted them. Let's discuss a few of them in the time that is provided. All personalities well known to scholars, but who had to wait three or four centuries before history would do them justice, would include such as Diego de Landa, Sagoon, Duran, Brazier, de Bourbourg, Botteruni, and others. Viscount Kingsborough was one of the most important, John Selden, and many others. A very fine book that deals not with all of these, but with the recovery of much of the manuscripts and records, is The Testaments of Time by Leo Duell. 400 years after his death, in 1579, Fray Diego de Landa is still awaiting history's final verdict on his person. Up to the present time, no one knows for certain whether the author of the famous Relaciones was a saint or a vile persecutor, an impetuous and ardent servant of God, or a cruel enemy of the native Indians. He died enveloped in the aroma of incense, but over the centuries he is remembered as the author of the dismally notorious Auto da Fe in Mani, Yucatan. It was here that he dedicated his efforts with religious zeal to the burning of Maya manuscripts, to destroy altars, idols, scrolls of signs, and hieroglyphs. I visited the chapel of the Landa, which was built over the upper portions of ancient temples and the temples nearby, and looked upon his figure. My son tried to take a picture of one of the paintings and did a very good job, providing an excellent photograph of de Landa in a room that was very dark. In reading the letters written to the king in 1563 by the then governor of Yucatan, one begins to doubt the logic of such skeptics when describing in one of his letters the torture inflicted on the natives by de Landa. The governor testifies that in a single province, more than 2 million idols were found of different types. Was this the fruit of imagination or bad faith or what? The life of this evangelist, friar, and bishop was obscure and full of contradictions. He received his habit at the age of 16, arrives at Yucatan at the age of 20. He burned the Maya manuscripts, but at the same time gathers together the essence of Mayan thought. He records everything he sees, observes, investigates, copies, and draws. An historian who never thought of writing a book, but writes one which remains forever in the history of culture, as he wanted thereby to pay the debt he contracted with future generations for having destroyed the monuments of native thought. Says J. Eric Thompson, "Without this book by de Landa, it is doubtful whether we would have made any progress in glyph decipherment, and we would know very much less about the Maya." I have a copy of de Landa's book, which became available just a few years ago. Landa was recalled to Spain, enduring the voyage perhaps to while away the long hours of idleness on the ocean, perhaps to have a document to present to the king. He wrote the Relación de los Cosas de Yucatán, in other words, report on the matters in Yucatán, of which 3 centuries later, another wise abbé, Brasseur de Bourbourg, would declare, "With this book alone he paid for what he destroyed in Mani." Now, I won't accept that. I believe the destruction was more immense than we'll ever realize. Those ancient books. But could this small, lean, austere, and asthmatic friar have been so evil? In spite of all the accusations and crimes that he tortured 4,500 natives, 6,300 were ill-treated, and 85,000 obliged, under force to don the penitent's robe, the very king he returned to offered him positions in 2 monasteries and has him returned to the same Yucatan where he had inflicted so much torture. He's a controversial figure today. Now, Fray Bernardino de Sahagún, around 1500 A.D., better known to us in that form than his original name, Bernardino de Ribeiro, was not interested in earthly pleasures because he chose a habit, devoted his long life of 90 years to ethnographic studies and to teaching his native catechism. This ordinary monk mastered Nahuatl with the same ease as Latin. He was just as interested in vocabulary as in art. A great deal of his time was spent in the areas of Monte Albán. He abandoned the professorial chair in the College of the Holy Cross in order to aid the Indians victimized by the terrible plague in 1545 that killed 800,000 people. He himself buried at least 10,000 until he became sick. This learned friar dedicated most of these years to the gathering of data and to writing his magnificent Florentine Codex. This is my copy of volume number one of that series that was translated in 1970. The volumes are, I have a dozen now. The Florentine Codex series by Charles E. Dibble, University of Utah, and Arthur J. O. Anderson, School of American Research Project. It's a translation of the General History of the Things in New Spain, written by Sahagún. The oldest text collected by him in Huatl, known today by the name of the Matreense Codices, are to be found, one in the library of the Royal Palace in Madrid and the other in the Royal Academy of History. Perhaps Sahagún's work would have lain dormant up to the present time were it not for a copy that was found in 1780 in the Franciscan Monastery in Toulouse. It was not until 1830 that the literary and scientific world of Mexico became familiar with the fruit of those 61 years of the friar's work. Sahagún died of the grip in 1590, victim of an epidemic. Really, he died of a cold. Now, the Abbey Charles Etienne Brasseur de Bourbourg used to say with pride that he was Flemish, but Danish and Kichi as well, in terms of his mother tongue. He said, "I remain what God has made me." He wrote in one of his books and confessed that it was an article on Palenque, one of the great ruins in the Gulf of Mexico, published in the Journal des Savants, that determined his vocation as an archaeologist. The only possibility for young Charles to visit the continent of his dreams was to enter a religious order. This is what he did. And soon we see him, the future Mesoamerican Champollion, serving as an abbey in the French legation in Mexico and afterward as a parish priest in the towns of Rabinal and San Juan in Guatemala. His first find, because he was on a deliberate search, is the Quiche Spanish Dictionary of Matul that he buys for 4 pesos, but due to lack of funds, he must sell later on to John Carter Brown of Rhode Island for $150. In the College of San Gregorio in Mexico, he discovers a manuscript in the Huatl tongue and gives it the name of the Chimalpopoca Codex in honor of Faustino Chimalpopoca Galicia, his teacher of this native tongue and a direct descendant of Moctezuma's third son. He learns about the existence of the Popol Vuh, sacred book of the Quiche Maya, and the main source of the Mayan mythology and history, and before long translates it into French. It would seem that ancient manuscripts find their own way into his hands, since he then discovers another equally important document written in the Kakakeli tongue and entitled the Soloa Memorial. Fortune appears to take him under her wing. Before long, in the archives of the Royal Academy of Madrid, he encounters the work of another writer, Dalanda, which is aptly called the Rosetta Stone of Maya writing. The discovery threw new light on the ideographic glyphs of the day and months in the Mayan calendar and made known the Mayan alphabet, still a matter of debate among scholars. And when interpreting Dalanda's manuscript, we find that he commits the error of considering it to be a source not only of Mexican history, but also of Egypt. But would he be wrong there? Once more, good fortune is his ally. During his stay at Palenque, his draftsman takes ill, and the abbey has to return to Europe. In Madrid, he meets Juan de Tro y Hortelano, a well-known paleontologist, in whose house he finds a rare manuscript. Curiously enough, its letters remind him of the alphabet transcribed by Dalanda. No one can ask more of destiny. He has discovered the famous Tro Codex. Even though Brasseur de Bourbourg's interpretation of the materials was incorrect, he did not find the Rosetta Stone that he hoped for. His contribution, nevertheless, was not diminished. He died in 1874. A few years before that, another French scholar, Aubin, was obliged to sell the collection he had smuggled from Mexico due to a loss of fortune in the Panama Canal shares. Joseph Maurice Alexis Aubin took the collection of historical documents that he had acquired out of Mexico in 1840. He unbound and jumbled them to prevent custom officials from getting suspicious. Aubin, who left France to do astronomical research in Mexico, however, fate had arranged for him to lose his scientific apparatus, leaving him without the tools of his work. He decided to stay in Mexico and devote himself to another disciple, to another discipline, the study of Nahuatl and the codices. He says, I was able to acquire some manuscripts and paintings from the legacy of the son of the celebrated Mexican astronomer Gama, who was highly esteemed by Baron von Humboldt. Aubin arrived in Mexico during a stormy period. In the years from 1830 to 1848, uprisings alternated with coups d'état. There were 26 changes of government in the course of 18 years, in addition to wars with France and the United States. He astutely deceived the customs officials in Veracruz and took the valuable collection to Paris that he had acquired. Perhaps it would have remained there unrecognized until the present time if it was not for José Fernando Ramírez, a Mexican scholar who met Aubin during a trip to Paris in 1855. Now, thanks to him, the French collector published part of the documents, thus revealing them to the scientific world. In 1889, he lost a large part of his fortune in Panama Canal shares and was forced to sell his collection. The Mexican Antonio Penafiel tried to buy it from him, arguing that it had no value, since such documents could be bought in Mexico by the ton. Well, I wish that was true. I've been to Mexico many times, and I've been unable to trace down more than one or two possibly authentic early documents. But he was unsuccessful. The entire collection was finally acquired that same year by Eugene Goupil, to whom Aubin sold it since he was afraid it would be stolen. Mr. Goupil, whose father was French and mother Mexican, at first thought of presenting the collection as a gift back to Mexico. But he finally decided to leave it in Paris. Much of the collection of Aubin is composed of papers that belong to the Italian scholar and collector Lorenzo Bottarini, whose destiny is no less interesting than his French colleagues. Bottarini died in 1755. At one time, his collection numbered more than 500 documents, most of which have been lost. This gentleman, Lorenzo Bottarini, Beneducci, Lord of Latoura and di Hoorno, born and educated in Milan and Vienna, his family tree could be traced back 914 years. It includes counts, marquises, and dukes. He was a friend of the most eminent nobility of Austria. He accepted an offer made by him, by Donna Manuela de Oca Silva and Moctezuma, a descendant of the Aztec family, to help aid the handicapped people of Mexico with a pension she received as a direct descendant of the royal Aztec family. She was a descendant of Moctezuma. So he arrived in Mexico to carry out the mission of this descendant of Moctezuma, a foreigner who openly collects funds without permission of the Council of Indice. He was suddenly taken and put into arrest for trying to acquire public collections, which came to attention. And the Virgin of Guadalupe displaying an Italian coat of arms instead of that of the King of Spain. And so as a consequence, on February the 5th, 1743, our learned scholar found himself in prison by the order of the Viceroy. He was arrogant, and all this did was earn for him an even worse cell and precarious conditions in the company of common prisoners. He was deprived of everything, abandoned without food, and with a blot on his honor. He left Mexico for Spain on the ship La Concordia. The gods did not favor him even then. The ship was boarded by English pirates who robbed the scholar of a little he owned, including his clothes. He was finally, in the dress of a sailor, put a foot from on the shore and had to walk from Gibraltar to Cadiz, where he appeared with a single possession, the manuscript of his idea for a new general history of North America, written during the crossing. But he was rehabilitated by the Council of Indies. He was appointed historian of the Indies by King Philip V and given an annual salary with the order that he return to Mexico to write the general history that he proposed. He then made a serious effort, but he never went back to Mexico. By 1840, of the more than 500 documents of his original collection, there were 303 original pages that were surviving before 1840. Shortly after that, only 88 were left, and these were found in various museums of the world. Many valuable papers, the ritual 260-day calendar of the ancient Mexicans, the Codex Tepecapan, the Lhotzian map, the Conitzan map, and others reached the hands of Monsieur Aubin, who had taken most of the collection, or some of it at least, and smuggled it out of Mexico of our unlucky individual. But the lucky ex-astronomer Aubin acquired the famous calendar from Franciscan monks by exchanging it for the Genius of Christianity, a book worth of all 8 pesos. An inventory was taken in prison in 1743 and again in 1745, in 1804 and 1823, each time there was ever diminishing pages of the estate of Boturini. Of the 200 manuscripts originally contained in the last inventory, only 38 were finally left as the manuscripts were scattered throughout the world. Boturini called his estate a museum. It was his only estate in the Indies, and then it became partly destroyed during the viceroyalty by soldiers in nearby barracks. And in Mexico, what is there today now? A Boturini, one codex, a library, and a street that bears his name. Kingsborough, Edward King, Viscount of Kingsborough, the work that he did towards deciphering the ancient Mexican manuscript is of incalculable importance. Unfortunately, our knowledge of the Viscount is meager. He died when he was barely 44 years old, in 1837. This Englishman, who spent his life studying ancient manuscripts, saw them displayed in London in 1834. He was so impressed that he resolved to publish them in Europe. The task of copying the designs in the codices was entrusted to an artist, draftsman, skilled in making facsimiles by tracings, and who was visiting the libraries of Europe at the time, A. Aglio. 5 years later, Aglio made his tracings. The first volume of Antiquities of Mexico appeared. 10 volumes in all were scheduled for publication. Much was preserved by this great work that otherwise would become lost in time. The work contains drawings from codices owned by various museums and libraries of Europe and acquaints the world for the first time with these great treasures. According to general opinion, Edward King, Viscount of Kingsborough, because of his noble labors and inability to pay, was placed in prison. Apprehended by creditors, he was jailed in Dublin, where he died of typhoid fever on February the 17th, 1837, without seeing the last 2 volumes of his work, which were published 11 years later. Now, Robert Devereux, who was born in 1566 and died in 1601, he was the second Count of Essex and a hero. He's, of course, known to history for being Queen Elizabeth's first lover. He's also known for other things, including the plotting with James of Scotland against the very queen. However, he is better known than all of this for taking to England the document known today as the Codex Bodley. He entered Cambridge University in 1578, and later on, when he became the audacious lover of the queen, it happened that during a trip he made to Portugal without Her Majesty's permission, that he there plundered the large library of Geronimo Osorio, Bishop of Faro, where he found the famous codex that today bears the name of Bodley. As Count Essex presented the manuscript to Sir Thomas Bodley as a gift. The only thing we know is that the Count was beheaded in 1601. On the last analysis, it seemed that the Countess of Nottingham had failed to deliver a ring that the Count had entrusted to her to give the Queen. Failing to receive the symbol of union with the Count, the Queen did not with order the order to behead him. Now, John Selden was born in Sussex in 1584. He was a prominent collector of rare manuscripts, an expert in Oriental languages, and had been in prison several times for defending the rights of Parliament. He was freed from prison during Cromwell's time and dedicated himself to the study of Hebrew, Arabic, Turkish, and Persian. Where and how he found the codex today named after him will always remain a mystery. The only thing we know is that during many years, this exquisite codex, Selden Codex, was considered to be an Oriental manuscript. The fate of codices themselves, like many who found them, has been rather extraordinary. The Maya codices have suffered an even sadder fate than the Mixtec or the Mixica codices. Some were destroyed by the Mayans themselves. There are 3 great codices, the 3 Mayan codices, the Dresden, the Trocortesiensis, and the Paris Codex. The history of the Codex Paris is the most spectacular. Leon D. Rosny, botanist and specialist in the Japanese language, found it in a wastebasket at the National Library of Paris in 1859. We do not know what prompted this man to salvage from a wastebasket. Papers were already being blackened by chimney smoke, but it was about 1.5 meters long, 22 centimeters wide. It is not known how it arrived at the National Library in Paris, nor for how many years or centuries it lay there. nor what hands tossed it into the wastebasket. The miracle is that, as we continue in detail, as in the case of the Codex Borgia, it was that someone like him was prompted on some incredible intuition to salvage it and bequeath it to posterity. Now, the Codex Dresden, its story is also lost in darkness. How the Codex went from Yucatan, or Tabasco, as some scholars suggest, to the King of Saxony's library in Dresden, where it came to rest in 1739, when an unknown person sold it to the director of the library, Mr. John Christian Goetz. This is a mystery. In order to save a Maya Codex, he chose an ex-chaplain of King of Poland and the Elector of Saxony, August the 2nd, in order to save this particular document. In the Dresden archives, under number 300, we find the following notation: an extremely valuable Mexican book with hieroglyphic figures. It was also he who revealed to the world the existence of the rare book when, in 1774, he published Peculiarities of the Library of Dresden, First Collection. And on the first page, he mentions the Mexican book with unknown characters, which was found in a private library in Vienna. This unknown something was publicly displayed for the first time in the year 1834. Its 39 pages contain prophecies, ceremonies for the new year, and charts on the movement of the planets, Venus and the solar eclipse, as well as scenes from the god Itzamna's life. Itzamna might be equated with Jesus Christ. They have not been totally deciphered yet. Most probably the codex would have continued dormant for many years, gathering dust on a shelf of the Dresden Library, were not for the curiosity of a librarian, Mr. Forsterman. He began to study the Maya codices as a mere pastime, which enabled him years later to deliver to the world of science commentaries of such value that to date they've not been surpassed. Half a century later, research into Mayan astronomy was enriched by another amateur, Mr. John Teeple, who was a chemical engineer. For professional reasons, he was obliged to take long train trips, and while away his time on them, he began to study Mayan codices. Perhaps we would know much more today about the contents of the Codex Dresden were it not for the two world wars. During the first, Martin Meishausen died prematurely. He was a young man whose extraordinary intuition led him to decipher the famous calendar of eclipses. Now, during the Second World War, another non-professional and a friend of Fosterman, the attorney at law Paul Schellhaus, was killed by the Nazis in 1944. He had written a description of 15 Mayan deities that has never been surpassed. Dusted off and delivered to men of science for study, the Codex Dresden was miraculously saved during the Second World War. It was kept in the Japanese Palace of Dresden, previously a wine cellar, together with other prized objects of the museum, and was on the point of being burnt when an intense bombardment set fire to the palace in 1945. This great destruction killed over 200,000 people. In fact, it was one of the most criticized 1,000 plane raids into Europe of World War II. It was saved from the fire but remained beneath the water, seeping into the cellar through holes made by the bombing. 2 weeks later, when the dampness first began to cause damage, the guards became aware of the disaster. Again restored, it was on exhibit and today in the Dresden Museum. Visitors who stopped to examine this rare book of the Maya, probably the oldest of the codices, know little of its contents, its vicissitudes. They're only interested in its artistic aspects. This huge orange book that I have here is the copy, facsimile, and commentary on the Dresden Codex. The contents and significant religious and other thought will be in future tapes. Now, the third Mayan codex, called the Trocortesian, named after Cortez, consists of 112 pages and is the longest of the Mayan codices. For a long time, it was thought to be two different documents, since it is composed of two parts, which puzzled scholars for many years. The first part, Tro, was made known, as we have previously stated, by the Abbe Brasseur de Bourbourg, who discovered it in the library of Juan Tro y Ortolano, a professor of paleography and direct descendant of no less a personage than Hernan Cortez himself. In the year 1867, a certain Juan Pelicias makes his appearance and offers an unknown codex to the Royal Library of Paris and afterward to the British Museum for the sum of 500 duros, believing it to be a fourth Maya codex. It was finally acquired by a private collector Jose Ignacio Miro. But when Mr. Leon de Rosny, the same person who retrieved the Codex Paris from the wastebasket, heard about it, he had no peace of mind and he went to Spain to examine the document. He was able to study it there as the property of the Spanish government in the Museum of America. When he realized it was the second part of the Tro Codice, he gave his discovery to the world in an exhibit held in the Palace des Champs in de Mars in 1892. I have here a very large book in Spanish by Bodo Sprans dealing with the documents of the Borgia group of Mexican codices and nature and character of God in these codices. The story of the Codex Borgia is most exciting. The Book of Prophecies, considered the most perfect model of the ceremonial calendar. It's kind of an interesting, incredible story. Many competent people have written descriptions of it, the Borgia Codice, and in this particular book, there's a group of around five manuscripts of similar relationship. Here we then go to a description of it by Baron Alexander von Humboldt, a nephew of the cardinal of the same name. Von Humboldt was able to study the manuscript directly. He writes, "I believe the codice belonged to the family of the Giustiniani princes. We do not know by what unfortunate coincidence it reached the hands of the servants, who, not understanding the value of the unusual figures, turned it over to the children of the house as a plaything. But fate, that great friend of science, had the cultured Cardinal Borgia walk through the halls of the palace at that precise moment. The cardinal was a connoisseur of ancient art, a famous collector of both pagan and Christian antiques, who did not hesitate to sell even the buckles of his shoe in order to buy a coin or other object that interested him. He was a passionate archaeologist and a linguist who knew many languages, among them Ethiopian, Armenian, Hebrew, Malabar, and a number of Hindu dialects. How was such a man not to stop short upon seeing a rare manuscript in the hands of children? The cardinal acted swiftly, but the children had already burned the first and last pages. When Napoleon's army approached Rome in 1798, Pope Pius VI entrusted the government of the city to Cardinal Borgia, who was imprisoned by the French, but soon recovered his freedom. Regarding the history of the codice, the only thing we know for certain is that that he still had it at the end of the 18th century. He died in 1804. On the eve of his death, he bequeathed his collection of documents, among them even Coptic documents, to the Congregation of Propaganda Fide, together with the precious codice. The cardinal's family later tried to recuperate the collection, but without success. From 1883 on, the codice was displayed and finally was transferred to the Vatican Library. It has 76 pages, is more than 31 feet long. In the year 1900, a senator and ex-minister of higher education, Signor Pasquale Vareri, was telling the American scholar Zila Notal some 30 years before that he'd been searching the Library of San Marcos and found an interesting document, a strange book. He says, "I once realized the great value of the text. And then when he returned some years later, the codex had disappeared. It had been sold to a wealthy Englishman living in Florence." At any rate, Zila Newtall was in a hurry, and she then departed with an idea of trying to find the ancient document. Her story is written elsewhere, but she again consulted with the Valeri individual, and though he had not seen the codex for 30 years and was not special in his matters, he still remembered the details. She was eventually able to recover the document, and the codex that Sir Robert, who died in 1873, bequeathed to her son Robert Curzon, the 15th Baron of Zoysia, was lying dormant in one of the shelves. And because no one had opened it for 25 years, it retained its brilliant colors. "When I could finally examine it in 1898, she writes, "I realized that it surpassed all expectations. The codex became the property of the British Museum, where Mrs. Newtall studied it diligently until she published it in 1901. I've already drawn attention to the copy that I have here of that ancient document. The story of the Codex Vienna is equally as interesting. It takes place in Germany also. It was sent by Cortes with another codex to Europe. What do we know? It may have been one of the first gifts sent by Cortes to the emperor. It may have arrived in Spain November the 5th, 1519, and perhaps one of the other codices was among them. We're not sure that the king ever really saw it. After Manuel's death, the same Charles married Manuel's daughter. It's a very complicated process, but we soon find that the it ends up available in one of the museums. We've now discussed briefly the recovery and discovery of the ancient Mexican codices. Others are available in such documents as the Mixtec kings and their people, the Aztec image, burning water by letters of sojourn, and the Zapotecs. It's been rather exciting as I've returned often and again to Guatemala, to Mexico, to Guadalajara, to various other places, trying to track down codices. In Guatemala, we learned that there were four available, one as big as a telephone book. One was supposed to have been brought back to the United States by a Mormon missionary in Colorado. We've been unable to track it down. But we did learn one thing, that there's a great deal of codices yet available. Some were found in Chiapas, Mexico. When Montejo took over in 1532 in Yucatan as governor, many of the Mayans hid their books. They knew what had happened to them elsewhere, and much of their precious valuables. We now believe that there may be in some of the highlands of Guatemala and elsewhere untouched, unfound codices, along with the ones that have been cataloged. We're now looking for someone, somewhere down the line, to be able to break the code. And the information that we do find available in many of them will be the subject of future descriptions of content, doctrine, and history. This has been rather fast and furious, but at least give you an idea as to what is possible and available for the interpretation of ancient religious thought in ancient Mexico and its parallels to Mormon doctrine. In the name of Jesus Christ, I pray that individuals become more involved in the preservation of ancient documents and their content. Amen.